First Unitarian Church in Portland. Save the VA from Privatization, a forum of veterans, VA caregivers, and union activists, features prize-winning journalist Suzanne Gordon, who will discuss the value and importance of the VA healthcare system and the current threats to the VA from privatization and outsourcing. Again, that's Save the VA from Privatization on Wednesday, May 16th at 5:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Underground Graduate School. Portland Underground Graduate School creates racial, lifelong learning opportunities that work for everyone's real lives. For more information, please visit www.pugspdx.com. That's Portland Undergraduate School PDX.com. And good morning. This is, as I said, KBOO Portland, your listener-supported and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mo Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kullberg is engineering. The Old Mo is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromised news media. Today, Patricia Kullberg reads from her article about the vanished town of Vanport, entitled "The Town with Everything But a Future," which was published recently in Street Roots. Denise Morris will report on Arizona's historic six-day statewide teachers' walkout. Bill Resnick concludes the program today with some thoughts on the U.S. military and climate change. It's not what you expect, so stay tuned. And old mole trooper that he is, Bill Resnick also leads off our program talking with Con Hallinan. Hallinan is a columnist for Foreign Policy and Focus. They'll be discussing the Iran deal that Trump may very well renounce in the next few days. A very risky maneuver.
Con Hallinan, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Con Hallinan is a columnist for Foreign Policy and Focus, a webzine. He's a retired journalism professor. He previously was an editor of The People's World. For more of Con Hallinan's essays, visit Dispatches from the Edge. Con, next Saturday, our erratic and bellicose president will announce his decision on whether the U.S. will stay in the Iran nuclear deal. Tell us about it.
Well, keep in mind what the agreement is. This was a multinational agreement. The signees are not just the United States and Iran. They're also Germany, France, Russia, China, and the European Union. So it's not a bilateral agreement between Iran and the United States. What it did was that it basically... Iran gave up its enriched fuel. It agreed to dismantle most of its centrifuges that you use to make enhanced uranium. And it closed down and bricked up its heavy water reactor, which can produce plutonium. So, I mean, at this point, basically what it did was that it made it pretty much impossible, at least in the short run, for Iran to develop a nuclear weapon. Now, what's at stake in this is the agreement is that if Iran agreed to do that, and they also agreed to take very, very intrusive international inspections, which have been carried out regularly and which have given the Iranians a clean bill of health on everything. It also was that the United States was and the European countries were going to withdraw the sanctions that were put against Iran.
Economic sanctions.
Right. And essentially what Trump is doing is he's threatening to reestablish the sanctions regime. It's not specifically renouncing the treaty. It is putting the sanctions back on, which, of course, is a violation of the treaty. Europeans are opposed to this. The EU is opposed to this. And the Iranians have said...
The Chinese and the Russians, too, I believe.
Yes. If the Iranians have said that if the sanctions are reimposed, then that's a violation in the agreement, and they will not be bound by it. It's a very delicate moment, and the thing that I find most worrisome is that there are two other developments which are paralleled here. Currently, you have these tensions in the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is the group that makes up the monarchies of the Persian Gulf. So, you know, Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Oman and Jordan, etc. And there's a battle between Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Qatar, because Qatar has closer relations with Iran, because they share, Iran and Qatar share a joint gas field together, and Qatar has always been somewhat more friendly to Iran than most of the other Sunni-dominated monarchies of the Gulf. So anyhow, this argument, this battle between Qatar and the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia has been going on for some time, and originally the Trump administration supported Saudi Arabia against Qatar. Now suddenly it's reversed its fields and essentially told Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to stop their blockade of Qatar and to end the hostility between it, because they want a united Gulf Cooperation Council. Well, why do they want a united Gulf Cooperation Council? Because if the attack comes on Iran, they want a united Gulf Cooperation Council to be a united front. The other disturbing development is that the Israeli Knesset has given the green light to the Netanyahu security cabinet to, on its own, decide to launch a military attack on Iran. Now, normally, the larger, the wider cabinet makes that decision. And a couple of years ago, when Netanyahu was contemplating, actually, and planning to attack Iran, the wider cabinet vetoed it, said, no, you can't do it. And they stopped it. Well, now this is a security cabinet, which is a much narrower group of people, and they're all Netanyahu supporters. So I see these developments, the ending of the agreement, the unification of the Gulf Cooperation Council under U.S. prodding, and the decision to narrow the group of people who can decide whether or not to wage war on Iran as very disturbing. I mean, it looks to me as if there is a plan to attack Iran at some point. I mean, it will have disastrous consequences, not only in the region, but I think wider for that matter.
This is Cable Radio in Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick talking to Con Hallinan, who is a foreign policy expert. He publishes a lot in Foreign Policy and Focus and Dispatches from the Edge. Con, you've been talking about the agreement. What did Iran get out of that agreement? They were being strangled by the U.S.
Right.
sanctions. They thought
right.
they were going to get a great increase in trade. In fact, their economy did rebound a little bit, not as much as they expected, or at least was sold in Iran. My sense is that Israel and the United States and Saudi Arabia are much less worried about Iran's nuclear development, some of which is for peaceful uses, apparently. But they may have decided that they need a bomb to protect themselves. But what they're worried about is the strength that Iran has gained over the last 10, 15, 20 years in the Middle East in supporting the Syrians and supporting Hezbollah in Lebanon. It's one of the strongest military forces in the Middle East, certainly the strongest of the Arab states that fought Israel to a draw. And when Israel invaded Lebanon, it was a tremendous defeat for Israel. My sense is Israel wants to destroy Iran and therefore limit their capacity to provide arms and other kinds of assistance.
Yeah, there's no question. Nobody, even the Israeli intelligence, has said that Iran was not building a bomb. All the, this recent stuff that Netanyahu came up with about that they were lying about it, et cetera, you know, that they are building a bomb, this is stuff that goes back to 2003. And again, none of the documents that the Israelis showed indicated that there are any real steps in the direction of producing a nuclear weapon, just that there were actions that potentially could have led to the development of a nuclear weapon.
And that in that in the early 90s, it's 10 years since those...
So it has nothing to do with a nuclear weapon. If there's unified agreement in intelligence services, is that the Iranians are not trying to build a nuclear weapon, and that they have been following precisely the nuclear agreement that was signed between all of the parties that I'm talking about. I do think what it has is that, you know, here you have a country of 81 million people. It's one of the largest in the Middle East, and it, you know, it's basically similar in population and to Turkey. It is a country that has always had a strong streak of independence, and the United States sees that independence as a threat, as does Saudi Arabia as well. All of this talk about Iranian subversion, it just turns history on its head. It was Saudi Arabia that financed the Iraqi attack on Iran in 1980. So essentially what Saudi Arabia tried to do was to overthrow the Islamic Revolution through an invasion by Iraq in 1980. So it's the Iranians who are the aggressive ones here? I mean, what the Iranians are trying to do is they're trying to protect themselves. And what the Saudis want to do, and the United States, is that they want to make certain that they dominate the politics, the economies, etc., of the Middle East. And then through dominating that, they have big influence on world market, etc. The Iranians are not a threat to anyone in the Middle East, except, of course, the monarchies.
This is Cable Radio, Bill Resnick for the Old Mole with Con Hallinan. We're talking about the struggle in the Middle East that's now becoming much more dangerous with the Trump administration perhaps reimposing sanctions. Con Hallinan, the Russians, the Chinese, and the Europeans are all signatories to the document, could say, well, too bad the U.S. has left, but we're going to continue trading with Iran. In fact, we may even increase trading with Iran. And we want to see that as a part of a great settlement in the Middle East.
That might happen, Bill. I think the problem there is that the United States has enormous power over international banking. International banking takes place because of the SWIFT system, which is the U.S.-created system that allows for the transfer of banking and money, et cetera, internationally. For instance, Iran is banned from using the SWIFT system. So it makes international banking really difficult for Iran. It makes it very difficult for countries to come in and invest in Iran. If the United States decides that it's going to reimpose sanctions and it's going to punish any country which violates those sanctions, they're capable of doing that. They exert a lot of power. I don't see the Europeans, for instance, really fighting back against the sanctions. I think they will not go along with reimposing them. They will protest it. But I think that they're not in a position to really do much about it. Now, the Russians and the Chinese have greater possibilities of doing that. The question is are the Russians and the Chinese going to invest a lot in Iran? China, maybe, not clear about the Russians. The Russians' economy is just coming out of a pretty steep recession, and international prices now for gas and oil are on the rise, and so they're doing better economically. But Russia's not a huge economy anymore. They actually have an economy that's smaller than Italy's.
They're trying to keep up a big army, too.
Right. So what impact they could have on Iran, I don't know. I do think, however, that there is a recognition on the part of the Israelis and the Americans and the Saudis that reimposing the sanctions, that there will be resistance to doing that, and there will be way people get around the sanctions, which is why I think they're really considering a military strike. I don't know what they would do with that. You couldn't possibly defeat a country like Iran in a war. I mean, we can't even win in Afghanistan. Last time we in the United States won a war was in Grenada. So I can't imagine what they would do besides a great deal of damage. I think it'd smash up Iran's obsolete air force and their little navy, and they could blow up a lot of stuff. But that's really it. You would just now essentially have a war in the heart of the Middle East that would be ongoing, and it wouldn't be a war in a place that's isolated like Afghanistan. This would be a war with 81 million people in an absolutely key, pivotal region of the Middle East. It's just insane.
Well, you know, my fear is that if they do go in, they're going to go in all the way. And all the way is the kind of warfare, actually, that they haven't waged in other places, but will experiment with in Iran, which is to destroy the entirety of the infrastructure of the country, the roads, the railroads, the water systems. Iran already is suffering from drought.
They could do a tremendous amount of damage.
In the words of Curtis LeMay, push them back to the Stone Age. He was...
Yeah.
In the Vietnam period, they had the munitions to do that. Now they have the munitions and the surveillance capacity. Has the U.S. moved their, whatever it is, Sixth Fleet, whichever fleet operates in the Mediterranean? We have fleets all over the world and many more military bases. Have they moved their fleet into, they did move it towards Syria.
They've increased the size of their fleet in the eastern Mediterranean. And in the case of a war, they could certainly put sufficient forces into such a war. As I say, they could do a tremendous amount of damage. They could not possibly win that war. Certainly the only way you're going to win war is if you do something like invade Iran, and that would be absolutely catastrophic, and we would lose that war. So I think you're right when you're saying that what they're thinking more on the lines of is just doing a tremendous amount of damage. Now, the things that you mentioned there, you know, those are illegal. Those are violations of the Geneva Accords. You can't destroy water systems. You can't destroy civilian transportation systems.
Yeah, you can't do torture either. And
no,
Trump
I know, we do it. I know. Yeah. Would people object? Yes, I'm sure that people would object. Would they do anything about it? I don't see how or what they could do. Certainly the United Nations couldn't do anything because the U.S. has a veto in the Security Council.
Yeah, well, there is some people who can do something, and that's how I think we have to conclude. Bill Resnick here talking to Con Hallinan on KBOO Radio. Con Hallinan, what could be done is the revival of a peace movement in the United States.
Yes. Yeah.
That seems to me really the answer. It could be the Chinese would break from the U.S. financial system and try and set up their own. They've been threatening that for quite a while.
Yeah, but, and there is movement in that direction.
Right. I mean, let's talk about the possibility of a peace movement. In the run-up to the war in Iraq, there certainly was a huge peace movement here. I have the sense there's a possibility of a revival of that.
Well, I think that if we actually get into a war with Iran, it's going to be hugely expensive. And that's going to come from where, particularly with the tax cut bill that went through. It's going to come by borrowing money, and we're going to drive up the national debt, and eventually that's going to result in massive cutbacks in subsidies, in Social Security, in support for education, infrastructure work, etc. So, I mean, I think that there's an objective basis there for getting people to say, look, this is a really bad idea. It's not in our priorities. And I think it's a real possibility. You know, you have a lot of opposition growing right now in the country to the Trump administration. And I think if that can be tapped, it can have a significant effect on whether or not the United States actually carries out what the White House would like to carry out.
Con Hallinan, really good talking to you. And I think the next conversation has to be about building of that kind of peace movement that would go well beyond just a peace movement, because there will be no peace without justice, and there's not going to be any peace and justice unless we deal with climate change, which is right now killing people in the Middle East and making life impossible, and that's going to keep increasing. In fact, if the U.S. won the war, it's not clear what they would get, but more people to bury. Con, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
I'm pleasure to be on the show, Bill.
And this is KBOO Portland, and you're listening to the Old Mover Addy Hour. Memorial Day 2018 marks the 70th anniversary of the flood that wiped out the WW2 era federal housing project known as Vanport. Patricia Kohlberg, our multi-talented engineer, reads from her article, "The Town with Everything But a Future," a tribute to the anti-racist activists of Vanport who overthrew the politics of accommodation that prevailed in pre-war Portland. The article was published in Street Roots on April 20th, 2018. Patricia's reading is divided into two segments, interspersed with music and information about the upcoming Vanport Mosaic Festival. Patricia?
Vanport City was a place of contradiction, at once utopian and Jim Crow, innovative and second rate. It was a town, they would joke, with everything but a future. Vanport, the World War II era federal housing project on the outskirts of Portland, was never meant to outlast the war. It was built in a year. It was destroyed in a few hours, engulfed by a massive springtime runoff out of the mountains. But in its brief lifespan of 5 years, Vanport birthed a militant anti-racist activism that would supplant the politics of accommodation, which prevailed in pre-war Portland. You couldn't live in Vanport unless you worked for a war industry. Most worked in Henry Kaiser's shipyards. At its peak, the town housed 42,000 persons, the largest wartime federal housing project in the country. People came from all over to work for Kaiser. Most of them were white. But by war's end, more than 15,000 African Americans had flooded into the area. Housing was scarce. Families slept in their cars, in cheap hotels, church basements, theaters, trailer camps, on grandma's sofa, or behind the bar at their cousin's saloon. None of them, black or white, was welcome in Portland. Someone had to build the ships, but the denizens of the Rose City did not want those coloreds and Okies making a home in their fair city. The local African Americans, fewer than 2,000 total in 1940, were respectable folks who'd worked hard not to call adverse attention to themselves. As described in a wartime study published in the Journal of Negro Education, they'd crafted a more or less congenial relationship with white Portlanders, which required a fair amount of looking the other way at local discriminatory practices. They did not welcome their new African American neighbors, those floaters and undesirables, they called them. And those signs, "We cater to white trade only," they'd never seen them before the war. They were especially fearful that the newcomers would disrupt the status quo, which, in fact, they did. Vanport was sunk down in the rich, dark bottomland of the Columbia floodplain, crisscrossed by sloughs and two shallow lakes, all muddy in the wet season, dusty in the dry. It was a mile squared off, utterly flat, and enclosed by four dirt levees. Unless you were a curious kid on foot, the only place to exit that swampy bowl was a slantwise road that climbed the eastern dike. You could get lost in that town easy because the apartment buildings all looked alike. Wood-framed, wood-sided, two-story buildings, they looked like barracks. No building in town was taller than two stories or any shade other than drab and dreary. The town had no center, no central square, no city hall, no commercial hub, no main drag. It had no pool halls, card rooms, bowling alleys, bars, or nightclubs, no place where you might make a fool of yourself, and probably that was the point. Liquor was prohibited, which didn't mean you couldn't find it in makeshift speakeasies all over town. The town had no newspaper, it had no churches. Sunday morning services were staged in school auditoriums and hosted by a revolving cast of ministers. There were parks, a swimming beach, and recreation centers, but the latter were underused and often deserted. Community was not so much dead in Vanport as never come to life, especially among the whites. But African Americans liked to organize dance parties. Just months after deadly race riots in Detroit in 1943, they threw a dance to raise money for the war. At the event, young African-American men invited white teenagers onto the floor. The authorities, sensitive to the feelings of white Southerners in Vanport and paranoid about race riots, shut down the dance. It was the communists, the story went, who put up the blacks to Dancing with White Girls. But really, who had time to play? 60-hour work weeks, and usually both parents worked. The wages were eye-popping, so long as you were white. In blatant violation of wartime federal employment rules, African Americans were offered only the lowest paid and dirtiest work on the shipyards. Kaiser blamed the Boilermakers local, who blamed the Boilermakers international, who said it had nothing to do with them. Wyatt Williams, a prominent African American lawyer, had helped the Boilermakers to set up an auxiliary union for African American workers alone. The auxiliary collected dues but provided no benefits, no collective bargaining, no protection against unfair discipline, no pathway for advancement. Despite wartime labor shortages, Kaiser fired hundreds of African American workers who refused to join the Jim Crow auxiliary. Folks didn't stand for it. Not Van Porter Julius Rodriguez, founding president of the local chapter of the Shipyard Negro Organization for Victory. Not Van Porter Lee Anderson, who sued Oregon Shipbuilding and the Boilermakers for the right to work as a welder. Not Reverend J.J. Klo, president of the local NAACP, which threw itself into the fray. And not Bill McClendon, editor of the People's Observer, who covered the conflict in Portland's only wartime newspaper for the African American community. And not Van Porter, labor activist and Communist Party member Sam Markson, who was once arrested for being white in the black section of Vanport, I kid you not, and interrogated by the Red Squad, the unit embedded in the Portland Police Bureau to spy on local activists. They were all part of the Double V campaign, victory abroad against tyranny and victory at home against racism. In what might have been the first signal that the politics of accommodation were about to end in Portland, the attorney, Wyatt Williams, was booted out of the NAACP for his collusion with the Boilermakers. In November 1943, the feds came to town to investigate the alleged discrimination. They issued cease and desist orders. Kaiser and the Boilermakers ignored the orders. In March 1945, the courts ruled in Lee Anderson's favor. But by then, the shipyards were all but shut down, and there were no more jobs for anyone. And now, a short break for Tom to tell us about the upcoming Vanport Mosaic Festival.
Thank you, Patricia. And this is the Omo Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. On May 23rd through May 28th, Vanport Mosaic will commemorate Vanport City and the 70th anniversary of the flood that destroyed it with the Vanport Mosaic Festival 2018. Festival highlights include live performances of a play, Left Hook, about community displacement in 1970s Portland, and a concert, From Maxville to Vanport, Stories of Two Unique Towns in Oregon's History. There will be film screenings of Priced Out, 15 Years of Gentrification in Portland, and Lost City, Living Memories, Vanport Through the Voices of Its Residents. Exhibits include Anywhere But Here, The History of Housing Discrimination in Oregon, Vanport, and Vanport, The Surge of Social Change, and the artworks of Hank Pender, Rhymes, Reflections on War Memory, Liberty Ships, and the Climate Refugees of Vanport. Historic tours include bus and walking tours at the site of the former Vanport City, Black Panther Party walking tour of Albina, and Shifting Gears, a bike ride through Portland's history of community displacement. And lastly, community engagement, including lessons from Vanport and Katrina, a dialogue to create community resilience during the extreme weather conditions, and Invisible Walls, a public crowdsourcing effort to document restrictive covenants and residential segregation in Portland. For more information and a schedule of events, visit www.vanportmosaic.org/festival-2018. Or more simply, just do a search for Vanport Mosaic Festival 2018. It sounds like a great event. That's May 23rd through 28th.
Him to To each life some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine. Into each heart some tears must fall, but someday the sun will shine. Some folks can lose the blues in their hearts, but when I think of you, another shower starts. Into each life some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine.
Into each life some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine. Into each heart some tears must fall, but someday the sun will shine. Some folks can but when I think of you, another shower starts.
And that was Ella Fitzgerald with the Ink Spots in their 1944 hit song, Into Each Life, Some Rain Must Fall. Vanport was a town of strangers, working three shifts a day, coming and going at all hours. It was noisy. Cars and trucks and buses night and day, dogs barking, cats yowling, babies howling, never a quiet time. It was trashy, too, in the way places got, when no one felt attached. Broken windows, debris in the gutters, litter blowing down the streets and collecting against the buildings. Cardboard palaces was what they called the apartments, corners cut everywhere you looked. Walls as thin as tissue paper, so you could hear every nose blow, every radio show, every go at it, your neighbors banging the bed. In winter, they turned off the heat and hot water at night, and too bad for you if you worked the late shift and wanted to shower before hitting the sack. There were rats and flies and mice and fleas and bedbugs and cockroaches, plus, like any place built on the cheap, Vanport was frighteningly combustible. Some 200 fires broke out in the first 2 years of the project. The neighborhoods of Vanport were largely segregated, and the hospital was Jim Crow, illegally and by design. The housing authority known as HAP kept separate housing waiting lists for blacks and whites, although they denied it. HAP wanted to segregate the schools in Vanport too, but the superintendent, James Hamilton, refused. Then he made a point of hiring African-American teachers at a time when the Portland school system had not won. Vanport schools became the crown jewels of the community, winning awards for their innovations, their meal programs, infirmaries, 24-hour childcare, after-school activities, and summer school. Kaiser loved Hamilton's vision because workers who weren't worried about their kids showed up for work every day. At the end of the war, developers were slavering to get their hands on the land to build a new industrial park. But what to do with all those people? White families blew out of there as fast as they could. But most of the African Americans were stuck, not welcome in Portland, not wanting to go back home to even worse conditions. Vanport shrunk to less than half its wartime population. By then, the Vanport Tenants League had organized to challenge the discriminatory practices of HAP and their Jim Crow housing scheme. The League staged large, angry demonstrations, alerted the federal overseers to HAP's deliberate and illegal circumvention of federal rules. Eventually, they forced HAP to back down. In 1946, Vanport College was erected in Vanport to serve the overflow of vets seeking to better themselves. HAP set aside apartments around the college for vets, called Veterans Village, which boasted new paint and picket faces, fences, and gardens. In another point of bitter contention, Veterans Village did not admit African-American veterans. A series of police and legal horrors sparked additional protests. The police killing of shipyard worker Irvin Jones, whose home they invaded while in pursuit of another man. The police killing of suspect Benny Sellers as he fled the scene of a burglary in Vanport. And the framing of Robert Foulkes for the murder of a white war bride and his subsequent execution despite widespread protest. All these men were African American. The rain began toward the end of May 1948, a warm deluge. Winter snowpack ran off the eastern peaks and poured into the Columbia River. The lakes below the western dike swelled to twice their size. Army Corps engineers stood atop the levees surrounding Vanport, measured and probed and conferred. The folks who'd scrambled up the muddy slopes to watch might have overheard one of the engineers say to the other, "This isn't a levee at all. It's just a railroad berm." Memorial Day dawned sunny and warm. Early that morning, a flyer was slipped beneath the door of every apartment advising residents that the dikes were safe and they would be warned to leave if necessary. Shortly after 4 p.m., the sirens went off. The dike, not really a dike, had burst. Soon, vehicles were plowing down roads that were like rivers. People on foot struggled with suitcases, baskets, and babies. Cars, trucks, and buses jammed the long incline of Victory Boulevard, their only way out. Within the hour, all the buildings were adrift in muddy, swirling waters. 18,000 homeless, scores injured, 15 dead. That was the official count, but certainly there were more. Families lost nearly everything they owned. The buck was passed back and forth between city, state, and fed so fast it flew through the air in a blur. Not until 1952 did a federal court decide that no one was to blame for the catastrophe, and no one, therefore, was entitled to compensation. The Vanport Tenants League joined with other activists to form the Vanport Citizens Emergency Disaster Committee. They protested not only the lack of compensation, but the housing of flood victims in rotten conditions in dilapidated trailers and former dormitories for shipyard workers. Pickets were dispatched. Marches were staged. A caravan to Salem was organized. Reporter Julia Rudolph wrote incendiary reports about the failures of HAP in the wake of the flood, and for exposing the truth, she was fired. 6 years later, many of these same activists, like Sam Markson and Julia Rudolph, would be hauled in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee and interrogated about their activities after the flood. The land was never reclaimed for industrial or residential purposes. It now hosts a golf course and a racetrack. Vanport College was reborn as Portland State University. The railroad embankment was rebuilt, again, not as a levee, but only as a railroad berm. Vanport was never built to last, but rather to service the industrial needs of a wartime economy, and in the process, to maintain certain race and class boundaries. But Vanport activists took up the fight for a better future for their kids. They were the first to challenge the politics of accommodation that characterized the pre-war African-American community. It was these men and women who set the stage for the civil rights protests to come. This is Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Patricia, for that moving remembrance of the gone but not forgotten town of Vanport. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Now, Denise Morris reports on the deal that ended Arizona's historic six-day statewide walkout, led by the state's newly formed Arizona Educators United and the Red for Ed movement. Denise?
Con Hallinan.
Today begins National Teacher Appreciation Week, with tomorrow, May 8th, being Teacher Appreciation Day. And along with all the obvious thanks we can heap on our teachers, this year we can add a very resounding thanks to teachers all over the country who have mobilized to push for the well-funded public schools our communities deserve. So thanks, teachers. Led by Arizona Educators United, 75,000 teachers and allies in red shirts launched the first ever statewide walkout April 26th as part of the fight for the future of public schools and improved working conditions for all school employees. AEU understood that millionaire Governor Doug Ducey's announcement that he would grant teachers a 20% raise by 2020 was an empty promise and demanded a dedicated funding source. AEU also insisted that Ducey and the state legislature address its other demands, including big raises for all school employees, not just teachers, restoration of school funding to 2008 levels, no new tax cuts until the state's per-pupil spending reaches the national average, and yearly raises for teachers to get them up to the national average salary. Writing for Fight Back News, News and Views from the People's Struggles, Jim Byrne has been reporting on Arizona Educators United and the Red for Ed movement and offers the following analysis of the deal that brought this historic strike to an end. A week after some 75,000 educators and allies flooded the Capitol in Phoenix, the decision to return to schools came as Republican Governor Doug Ducey signed the education portion of the state budget. In that budget is a proposed 10% raise for teachers this coming school year. As local and national news outlets circulate the story that Governor Ducey gave Arizona educators a 20% raise, we must take a closer look at the deal and seek truth from the facts. In Arizona, a yearly state budget determines the funding sources and the plan for the monies to be spent on select programs. With Ducey's deal, he chose to include the 10% in only this year's budget and consciously selected to place two more years of 5% increases in future budgets. This is constitutionally impossible in Arizona, as a governor cannot tell a future legislature its budget. Thus, the future 10% raise is a lie and will most likely result in another struggle from the educators' movement. Moreover, the raise is not going to be funded from new sources of revenue like corporate income tax or closing the $14 billion per year corporate tax exemption loopholes. Rather, the funding comes from Ducey's rosy projections based on the first quarter of 2018 and the enrollment of people in certain programs like the state healthcare system, work opportunities for the developmentally disabled, and other important programs for working people on the margins. For many in Red for Ed, this feels like a punch in the stomach, knowing that many of their students and families could be negatively impacted if the funding dries up for the programs on which they survive. It must be recognized that on the one hand, the success and power of the Red for Ed movement forced a nearly immovable Republican state government to pay its educators better, and on the other hand, there's more duplicity involved in this deal. The 10% raise is specifically written for certified teachers who have a classroom roster, despite the demands of the movement to expand that definition to include certified staff whose roles are important but are not in the classroom. The Red for Ed movement also demanded a significant raise for classified or support staff. What's more, Ducey deviously designed this setup so that districts and staff are left to squabble with each other, not the governor, over how that raise is divided up. This means that for the movement to remain true to its demands, it is in a position to have to spread the funds from the 10% allocated for certified teachers with a roster to all public education employees. Therefore, this raise of 10% is washed out and lowers the actual amount as it spreads over more workers. One more final detail about this deal reflects the spiteful use of state power from this rotten Republican legislature. They raised taxes by 9% on property owners in the Tucson Unified School District. They vengefully targeted this district that had one of the highest votes in favor of the walkout and also contains some of the poorest working-class neighborhoods in the state. This brief analysis is from Jim Burns, writing for Fight Back News, an online newspaper dedicated to building the people's struggle. While the deal from Governor Ducey may likely lead to more statewide actions in the future, reflections on the walkout and organizing found in a piece by Eric Blanc for Jacobin Magazine Online reveal that AEU members are more than aware of the struggles to come and the important role solidarity will play in the fight against Arizona's entrenched power brokers and their attempts to divide workers. When asked what were her highlights from the experience of the strike, Arizona educator Rebecca Garelli pointed to solidarity. quote, definitely the sense of solidarity. People here never really had that feeling before, that sense of being part of a union and fighting together for one purpose. But this struggle has given people an awareness that they're not alone in this fight. The movement and the walkout really increased people's political awareness and our levels of grassroots organization. 50% of the win here has been that we now have a strong, organized mass movement, and we're not going away. People now have the courage to fight. As for the high level of right-wing attacks on the Red for Ed movement, Rebecca Gorelli points out, quote, Arizona is ground zero for Koch brothers' money, ground zero for charters, ground zero for vouchers, ground zero for privatization. We're in the thick of it, and we're up against a massive wall. I knew it existed, but it's greater than I ever imagined. I really think our members saw the nature of the government here. It all comes down to lining their pockets through these investment projects. That's where the right-wing attacks come in. In her response to concerns that this budget incorporates some important concessions to the movement, Rebecca Gorelli has a different analysis on the possible cuts to funds serving vulnerable communities. Quote, the main positive is that 8 weeks ago, we weren't going to get this much in funding from the state. In these 8 weeks, we've moved the needle on a government that didn't want to give us anything. We've increased the added education revenue from $65 million to more than $400 million. We were going to get a 2% raise, and now they're giving us what they're touting as a 10% raise. Also, the initial proposal Governor Ducey made was just for a stipend, but we succeeded in getting this raise put into the base. There's another important win. In the governor's original budget proposal, he wanted to find funds for the raises by stealing money from other programs. For students with disabilities, from Medicaid, from the arts, these cuts would have been very damaging to vulnerable populations, and they would have been very detrimental to our cause. Now, because of the pressure of the walkout, they removed those cuts. We did that. That was a win. The fact that this movement, in the span of 8 weeks, forced a right-wing government to make concessions is a big deal. So, is the budget enough? Of course not. Are we going to come back for more and get everything we demanded? Yes, we are. We're going to pivot and go fight to get that money ourselves. We need to fight for the money for our kids and colleagues because they've been left out. That is Arizona Educator and Arizona Educators United organizer Rebecca Gorelli from an interview in Jacobin Magazine online. This has been Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, it won't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take a kid to the seashore. It ain't quite this simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Cause if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be a-waiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried, gone to heaven. St. Peter'll be the straw boss then. Now you know you're underpaid, but the boss says you ain't. He speeds up the work till you're about to faint. You may be down and out, but you ain't beaten. You can pass out a leaflet and call a meeting. Talk it over. Speak your mind. Decide to do something about it.
Thank you, Denise. The song you just heard was Talking Union by the Almanac Singers. Today there is a national call to action to stop Chase Bank, the number one bank in financing dirty fuel. Portland will hold an event today, May 7th, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Chase Bank, Southwest 6th and Yamhill. J.P. Morgan Chase is the only U.S. bank funding the proposed fracked gas pipeline to Jordan Cove, Coos Bay, carrying very volatile and dirty gas to ship to Asia. It is also funding a new version of Keystone XL pipeline. Chase is the number one financier of extreme fossil fuels on Wall Street. Today's Portland event is sponsored by 350 PDX, divestment, reinvestment, and fossil fuel teams. Join in action to stop one of the most destructive businesses on the planet. There will be street theater, placards, and music today from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Chase Bank downtown at 6th and Yamhill. Now Bill Resnick is back to conclude our program today with a provocative thought. that with all its hundreds of sins, at some point in the life of the planet, the U.S. military will be decisive in the struggle to stop climate change.
Yes, it's sort of a, would be a controversial hypothesis. We have to change our relationships with the Army. I read the left press and can assure you that it's journals, blogs, books, documentaries, everything is brimful of critiques that attack the U.S. military, and of course, nearly all of it is deserved. For example, Chalmers Johnson in his book, The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic, he argues that if present trends continue, four sorrows are certain to be inflicted on the U.S. Their cumulative impact guarantees that the U.S. will cease to bear any resemblance to the country outlined in the Constitution, and he goes through all of the ways of state of perpetual war, more terrorism against Americans, growing reliance of weapons of mass destruction amongst smaller nations as they try to ward off the imperial juggernaut, a loss of democracy and constitutional rights as the presidency fully eclipses all other parts of government and transforms into a pentagonized presidency. Johnson goes through many other ways. In addition, of course, the left is still and rightfully quoting Smedley Butler 100 years ago, pointed out in a remorseful memoir of his 33 years in the military. I quote Smedley, "I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service, and during that period I spent most of my time as a high-class muscle man for big business. This is a general of the United States who led the Marines and all over Latin America and other continents. I was a muscle man for big business for Wall Street and the bankers." And then he lists all of his engagements in all of the countries in which he killed vast numbers of people. And he concludes that statement with, "Looking back on it, I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was to operate his racket in three districts. I operated on three continents." And in the 21st century, 100 years later, our military is training the militaries of our allies, including murderous dictatorships in Honduras and Colombia, among others, and torturing and death squad development and management. Anyway, there's also much more, what it does to its volunteers, lies to them about all the great jobs they're going to get when they get trained in the military. And there's much more, all of the vast surveillance they do, its sexism and inability or unwillingness to stop male violence in its ranks, and there's so many other critiques. The vast amount of money that creates almost no jobs, the starving of social services in order to keep that military siphon going to the military-industrial complex. Anyway, you've probably heard all of that if you listen to KABU and our show. Anyway, all of that's accurate, and there are many other things that we could say. Still, we need to examine and perceive the military with a wider lens, because they're not going to go away because we critique it. The military will remain a major power in this country and the world for the foreseeable future. And secondly, we have to reevaluate how we relate to the military, and that's because they will be crucial in determining whether this planet is going to survive climate change. And in fact, they could be the single biggest factor in saving the planet. Well, how could I say that? Well, it's not because they're still the biggest polluter. Even if they magically cut their emissions to zero, that the rest of the world and the capitalist world, which is the world, continue to burn more and more fossil fuels and plow more and more land and eat more and more beef and all the rest of the sources of greenhouse gases. If they continue to do that, we are headed to doom, a climate catastrophe, and they are not going to stop, because almighty capitalism, which has conquered the state and economy across the globe, they will not and cannot interrupt the growth and accumulation process whose dynamism is the core of the system. They will just keep going to pile up profits. And any business executives who says enough is enough, no more profits, we're going to do a steady state company, they'll be replaced by the companies and banks and investors and stockholders. They'll replace that executive with someone who will pile up profits. That means at some point we are sure to face a climate crisis, and that means food prices spiking, coastal cities and areas partly or wholly underwater, and non-functioning, great storms destroying infrastructure and much of the countryside, and not repairable. And that's even before that, in the early stages of that, the people are going to awake and demand a vast mobilization to transform the economy into zero carbon and still produce enough to sustain humanity and have to do it quickly before it is too late. At that point, there's going to be a great struggle between a democratic left on the one side and an authoritarian, xenophobic corporate force on the other, and they're going to be struggling for the authority to direct that mobilization. In that struggle, even though it was capital that polluted the world and refused to recognize climate change, the capitalist elites will claim their industries are the only way to produce enough of what we need. And in that struggle between the left program and capital's program, the allegiance of the police and military will be crucial. And if the military and police remain committed to capital and all those elites, all is lost. What does that mean? It means we on the left must change our relationships to the military. To be sure, we must continue to critique the military for all its sins. But we have to educate them to appreciate our democratic program. In fact, that is very possible, because the military for itself has for some time acknowledged climate change. In fact, one recent article in a military-oriented journal wrote, "The Department of Defense has emerged as an unlikely champion of climate action in the Trump government, with the Pentagon declaring emphatically that a rapidly warming world is bringing with it alarming security risks." And then they go through the risk. And in fact, the Norfolk Navy base is going to be the first to go and be flooded, and the Navy knows it. Furthermore, the military has a research program. We don't have time to get into it. In small-scale, mobile, very cheap electricity-producing devices. And that's, of course, because they want... They're losing lots of people and huge amounts of money having to carry oil to all of their 853 bases around the world. It's extremely expensive in terms of their lives, and they need solar and wind generating devices, and they're putting money into it. They know climate change. In any event, I could go on for a while, but I'm not going to. The time is up. But we really do have to work with the military, educate them, and build movements that reach the military such that they appreciate the superiority of the left solution to climate change in comparison to capital solution. Anyway, this is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill. And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kohlberg has been our engineer and commentator. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view. That is, from the ground up. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. Today's program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. Now, coming up at 10, it's Wokus Focus. Barbara Bernstein talks to Paige Embry, author of Our Native Bees, about the plight of the pollinators. At 11, Retired or Rewired explores aging in Portland with Dr. Karen Brown Wilson. And at 11:30, Madness Radio interviews Grammy-winning singer-songwriter Susan McGowan, who says rituals and music have the power to heal emotional suffering.